If I were to say, the Primarchs, all of them, are but a means to an end.
I do not understand. Forgive me.
The Imperium is not for the post-humans, but for mankind. You know this. You helped me to manage them, to direct their efforts. The legions and their sires are conquerors' tools and nothing more.
You mean the Thunder Warriors?
Like them, burning brightly but briefly. But the Emperor and I could not conduct the Great Crusade with gen-hanced mortals. We needed something greater, something stronger to reclaim the stars. And in order to control it, we needed a lifespan for the Legiones Astartes that had nothing to do with aging or timed infirmity. Believe me when I say it, Sybil Niasta, this was always intended to be the final act of the Crusade. We wanted the Primarchs to turn against one another, against their father. Be assured, we maneuvered each of them from the moment of their rediscovery, pitting them against one another, stoking their brotherly rivalries with his unequal favor. It was not difficult, no more so than positioning pieces on a Cheops board. Those who could not be managed well, they would never reach the end game. Do not weep, my dear. You fear that the Emperor cannot control his sons, and yet I tell you that this war is the method of that control. The Primarchs have no more free will than we gave them.
Can it be true?
My failure was in underestimating the true enemy. The ruinous powers have emboldened their champions among the 18, and the war began before we were ready. And so, every toll of that bell gives me pause to question. Was this death one we intended, or yet another innocent soul I might have saved? That is my burden to bear, and I do so, so that the Emperor may concentrate on the final battle to come.
Will he win?
The future is not my area of expertise. I trust in his vision, as we all must. I am here, Sybil. I am here. You must sleep. I won't let go. Let yourself fall. Let yourself fall, and he will catch you. This I swear. Give yourself to him.
The dawn came. The first paling of the eastward horizon over Gangjiang had a peculiar golden quality to it, even through the grimy haze above the sprawling refugee camps and the polychromatic shimmer of the palace's active void shields. Malkador remained at Niasta's bedside, watching as the sun climbed over the horizon, bathing the old Himalaya in its serene light. He could remember every detail of every sunrise he had ever seen, and they were many, and yet he could not recall another that held both the perfect beauty and sadness of this one. He still held her cold hand, and he looked down at the tiny golden charm that lay beside it. The Imperial Eagle's sighted eye was a single emerald, no larger than a pinhead.
You promised. You promised me it wouldn't be like this. I lie to them to spare their sorrow, even as I envy their mortality. And it breaks my heart. It breaks my heart.
Swallowing his grief, his loneliness, Malkador gently laid the astropath's hands upon her chest in the sign of the Aquila, with the charm neatly placed on top. Then he rose from the chair and looked upon her one last time.
Goodbye, old friend.
Slowly, He drew up his hood and raised one open hand to the shadows. His staff flew through the air into his waiting grip. With a dazzling flare, the Psi-Flame sprang into life at its head once more. He was Malkador. He was the Sigilite. He was First Lord of the Imperium. And he knew, with all certainty, that the end was coming.
Begin transcription.
Compliance.
Commission of the Compliance of 8540. Dictated by Iterator Tertius Galan and submitted as record to the War Council of Terra. PMN was a jewel turning in the void. Continents of deep green, ringed by vast oceans, wrapped in delicate bands of cloud. She was so like Terra, our ancestral home had once been. And like Terra, mankind lived upon PMN and thrived. It had not always been so. Following the cataclysm of Old Night, the PMNi languished for centuries beneath wicked aliens that held them in chains. Violent revolution drove the Xenos away, and for a century, PMN knew peace. Alone in the night. A peace that was challenged by the arrival of grand ships. Though these were not the aliens intent on returning PMN to enslavement, these ships carried humans, like those of PMN. We came as heralds of the Emperor of Mankind, of his uniting of all humanity into a single Imperium. Of progress, a technological and cultural utopia beyond their wildest dreams. All of this we promised to them, if they bent the knee. The PMNi looked back upon their history, upon the bondage they had so recently cast off, and rejected us. We begged they reconsider. Warning that those who refused to align with the Emperor's burgeoning realm would be visited again, and not by emissaries. Still, they could not bring themselves to give their fate over to the hands of outsiders, even human ones. PMN would be free. And for a time, it was. That freedom ended. The moment the Emperor's promised vengeance translated at the system's edge. We failed, PMN. We failed them by what we sent.
Curse. A Lesson in Darkness by Ian St. Martin. Performed by John Banks, Beth Chalmers, Matthew Hunt, Jonathan Keeble, and Toby Longworth.
Natu! Bene Mora!
Weapons filled the hands of the PMNi Triari squad sprinting through their flagship. The enemy fleet had arrived in system out of nowhere, as if they were part of the void itself. Since that moment, the PMNi had been fighting, and they were losing.
Oleas todol, Antaris todol, Creada todol, Halabus kilavetis!
As ship after ship from the defense fleet died, reports filtered through of hulking red-eyed giants rampaging through the lower decks. The Triari clutched their weapons tighter. The Imperial emissaries had warned of knights, gene-wrought gods of war, not monsters. The squad halted at a junction, Each man's stomach knotted, and static boiled their tongues. Hair rose on arms and necks, ears popped as the air pressure shifted violently. Light and noise from the end of the corridor threw the squad to the deck. The Triari lowered their hands from their faces, scrambling to their feet and into a hasty formation. They peered into the darkness, blinking away after images that stained their sight as oily smoke swirled around their boots. Something was watching them at the end of the passageway, merged with the lightlessness like shadow draped over oil. Lightning rushed across hands, ending in scything silver talons, illuminating an inhumanly tall silhouette. Sparks exposed a gaunt face hidden behind a veil of dark, stringy hair. They glinted from a set of grinning teeth, filed into points.
Zimpathak!
The walls rang from kinetic scatter cannons and bulky spear guns. Any shot that found its mark barely scored the figure's buzzing plate. It didn't even break stride. In seconds, it was over, with only one of the soldiers left amidst the charnel house that had been his comrades.
Bota!
The man gasped, his weapon falling from his hands as he sank to his knees. The figure did not speak the man's language. He had no need to. The Triarius's eyes translated it perfectly.
Bota! Bota!
It was the most familiar word in the galaxy. A word the figure linked indelibly to all mankind. A word that made him hate them to his bones. Please.
Curse.
The demigod peered down, tilting his head to study the man with cold shark's eyes.
Kurz
saw hope for an instant. Hope that died at the edges of his talons. Kurz ignited his claws, splaying them wide and severing the Triarius into bleeding chunks. He hadn't even had time to scream. Kurz spent several heartbeats watching the blood cook off his talons, filling his nose with the familiarity of burning copper. He shifted fractionally, his arm and shoulder giving off a soft, displeased snarl. The heavy plates of humming ceramites made him uncomfortable. Not in any physical sense, but rather one of necessity. He stared at the bodies scattered beneath him.
My entire life, I wore nothing more than threadbare sackcloth and rags, killing with slivers of metal and broken glass. Simplistic ornaments and implements, but sufficient to my purposes. I never needed any high technology to dominate my environment. Yet, I conceded, one of many made after my reclamation. Appearance, they said, a powerful tool to cultivate. The image of the armored knight that seems marrow-bound within your race. Exemplar of nobility to friend, formidable opponent to foe. Appearance. As though I did not render my entire world silent through its use. As though I were ignorant of the power of perception to bend humanity into compliance. I know such truths instinctually, as my creator must have intended. Surely the Emperor knows what lies in his children's hearts. Surely he knows full well what we are and what we will do in the years to come. Or does he simply not care?
Bootsteps drew the Primarch's attention, yet failed to move him. Squads of midnight-plated warriors passed, the corridor's darkness broken by the gleaming tourmaline of their eye lenses. Seeing Kurz, the Night Lords faltered. The dilemma was clear in their postures, the desire to kneel in their father's presence so overwhelming it slowed them to a stilted scraping of ceramite boots. One look from their captain sent them forward, smashing every light source they came across to plunge the warship into darkness. Kurz glimpsed the captain, Nivalis, in a puddle of blood upon the deck, and his mind draped a skin of flickering images across his vision.
I see a child, hauled screaming from the prison sprawls beneath Terra. I see Nivalis, of the Legion now, rejoicing. His gene, sire, has been found. He will never again enter battle without the Primarch whose blood beats through his hearts. He and his kindred speak, wondering just who their Primarch will be. Would I share the implacable resolve of Dawn, the Crimson King's esoteric mysticism, the soulful majesty of Sanguinius?
My lord.
Kurz did not rise from where he crouched, his back to the captain.
We have secured the ship. Crew casualties have been minimized. All systems are in working order, as you commanded.
We control the bridge?
Yes, lord.
Kurz rose in a snarl of energized joints. He dropped something Nivalis could not identify onto the deck.
Secure the ship.
We have
Make certain. Then meet me upon the bridge.
As you wish, my lord.
The Primarch slipped into the darkness, leaving the captain to look down on the Triarii's flayed faces, which stared back at him without eyes, moaning silently from slack mouths. Captain Nivalis approached two sergeants guarding the bulkhead leading onto the flagship's bridge, looking upon him with blank-faced helms in the gloom. Their midnight plate bore only superficial damage, scuffs and scrapes that did little more than mar the lacquer.
Casualties during the assault were light, Captain.
I had anticipated stiffer opposition in taking her. The elite of a civilization opposing us, and only 100 legionaries to bring her to heel.
Mortals, no matter their training or equipment, can only stand so long against a legion's might.
A lesson being taught to thousands of worlds across the Crusade. Tonight, brothers, Piamen is learning it firsthand.
The sergeant saluted, clashing armored fists against breastplates as the doors irised open. Nivalis arrived on what had been the flagship's bridge, but was now an abattoir. Bodies were strewn in all directions. Orphaned limbs dangled precariously from consoles, tumbling to the deck. People hung from the vaulted ceiling on chains and severed power cables, most without their skin. Nivalis had seen enough death to know from their eyes, set and glazed like dolls, that they had been alive while it had happened. The entire bridge crew had been slaughtered, excluding what Nivalis concluded was the Piemeni equivalent of servitors. Rail-thin men and women hung in glass flutes, their bodies deformed by spurs of pulsing psi crystal, linking them to the ship's inner workings. The technology was unmistakably alien in origin, drawing a revulsive sneer to Nivalis's lips. None of these slaves had been touched, oblivious to the carnage surrounding them. Nivalis was no stranger to death. He was a veteran of the Venori resurgence on Terra, and dozens of other campaigns won at the edge of 8th Legion blades. Theirs had always been a cold, clinical violence. Fear was a weapon, a means to an end, and the Night Lords wielded it like a scalpel. This was something else entirely. Nivalis removed his helmet. Butcher's spice filled his nostrils, so hot and immediate it stung his eyes. Something cold and silvery, a sensation he couldn't place, coiled around Nivalis's heart. His helmet crashed to the deck, his sword's tip sighing against the edge of its scabbard as his eyes, born in darkness, found his lord.
This ship is called Storm's Rock.
Kurz, perched atop the backrest of the ship's command throne, his inhuman height folded into a gargoyle's crouch. The Primarch flexed his talons, watching drops of blood slip from them onto the corpse of an aging man seated upon the throne.
Did you know that?
Yes, Lord. From the intelligence reports of the iterators first sent to this world.
I learned it from eating her master's heart.
Kurz licked his lips before nudging the corpse from the seat of the throne to spill onto the deck. Nivalis looked up from the corpse of the ship's captain.
Storm's Rock, named for the battle that granted Piamen independence from a particularly sadistic offshoot of the Eldar Xenobreed.
Freedom won with the blood of thousands of hearts. Would they rail against their sacrifice, I wonder, if they saw how few years it bought before the end? How shallow a future.
Kurz stepped forward, the preternatural quiet of his movements betrayed by the waspish purr of his armor. He stopped before a console.
What are you looking for, Lord?
This ship's crew stands at 270,000. Excluding the servitor population, it leaves 180,000 living, breathing souls.
Kurz projected a wireframe schematic hololith of the flagship. The Primarch's talons flowed deftly over the controls, illuminating and expanding several internal sections.
The main hangar. There are adjoining cargo sprawls here and here. Empty them and tear down the walls. We need a large open space.
For what, my lord?
The crew. Gather them up, Captain. All of them.
The sun shone through thin clouds over Erebust, vibrant metropolis of Piamen. Peals of thunder drew millions of eyes upward as the streets darkened. The low clouds hanging over the city became a deep umber. Storm's Rock, their flagship, presented herself in all glory. Word had spread of war in the heavens. Prayer filled every mouth as their defenders rode out to meet the invaders. Prayer that Piamen might keep hold of its freedom. Horns blared from the ship, swaying trees and sending papers twisting through the thoroughfares. After the Battle of Storm's Rock, when the last alien died upon Piamene soil, when freedom had been won, horns had sounded across the planet. It was the sound of victory, one that every man and woman of Piamene carried within their hearts. Cheers erupted from the city as they heard the call of triumph once more. People filled the streets with celebration. The invaders had been driven off. Piamene's future would remain her own. On a street corner, people halted in their revelry, craning their necks to see a growing circle of their countrymen at the center of the intersection. Something had fallen and struck the ground, reduced to an indistinguishable heap smeared across the rockcrete. More cheers were silenced, cut off and overtaken by a rising swell of alarm as another shape splattered against the pavement. Then another, and another. The people looked up, panic and confusion twisting their faces as a pinkish-red cloud poured down from Storm's Rock. Citizens scattered as more of the shapes came down. They crashed against buildings and flattened groups who failed to avoid their path. A woman screamed as one of the things smashed the roof of an autocab flat, seeing half of a skinned face staring back at her. Bodies. It was raining bodies. Kurz and Nivalis watched Erebust disintegrate into madness through the Storm's Rock's oculus. The blood had yet to dry on Nivalis' gauntlets, slathering him to his elbows. He had done as much as the men acting upon his orders. The Primarch had been right. They had needed all the room they cleared and more to do what he had commanded. They had even crushed down the deck into pits to heap the skins of the wailing souls who had been wearing them before being herded off the ship.
The Emperor, did he know what we would do here?
He sent me.
Kurz smiled, a ghoulish flash of teeth framed by blue lips that vanished as soon as it appeared. He looked back at Nivalis, eyes swallowed by dark pupils.
I am not here to be their last chance. After my father came to Nostromo, after he brought me into all this, he tasked my brother Fulgrim to teach me about Terra, humanity, the grand dream my father is building. Do you know what I learned?
Kurz took a severed head in his claws, tracing around the eyes with a talon's tip.
The similarities that humans share vastly overshadow any differences. No matter the language, culture, history, every one of them understands one thing. Fear. Fear is something so profound that it reaches into their little animal brains and renders them silent, malleable, submissive. Fear will bring peace and order to my father's new kingdom. It will bind humanity with chains stronger than any we could ever hope to forge.
Nivalis strode to a Vox station, pushing aside a corpse from the strobing console it attended.
Transmission relaying from Earbust and sendings from an astropathic choir. Distress calls. We can jam them.
No.
Lord?
Kurz's gaze did not stray from the head he held, as though he were speaking to it.
Don't interfere. Use this ship to strengthen the signal. Have the fleet do the same. Broadcast it loudly and clearly. They want their sister worlds to know what is happening to them.
So do I.
Pinpricks of light flickered to silent life as fires began to break out across the city. Order disintegrated, drowned by the human rainfall, driving the population into a delirium of fevered anarchy. Erebast tore itself apart without a single Imperial boot on its surface.
My brothers, my father, they erect monuments of stone, of gold. I shall make mine of flesh, of humanity itself.
What of the civilian population?
These are enemies of the Emperor, Captain, of progress. They were given a choice, and this is what they have chosen.
The head collapsed within Kurz's grasp. He threw it aside.
It takes 9 seconds to drain a body of blood. How many for a civilization? My mandate is to render this world compliant. Terra accomplishes this with swiftness beyond any invasion. Soon, all that we shall require to conquer is the threat of our arrival.
Kurz gestured for Nivalis to stand beside him. Even in the midst of everything, he could not look away from his Primarch. Despite the threadbare sanity of his words, the monstrosity of his deeds, his father was beautiful in a way Nivalis knew he was never meant to understand. This cruel angel.
My blood flows through your veins. You feel it. You know the truth I speak.
Nivalis looked at the blood drying on his hands.
We have always been the Emperor's retribution, his punishers. But this, sire, they will not call war. They will call it murder.
Two words for the same thing. I suggest you make peace with it, Captain. You are in my legion now. This is how Night Lords make war.
Kurz laid a talon upon Nivalis's vambrace, sliding it over the ceramite and gathering a measure of the blood upon its tip.
It felt strange the first time, didn't it? Don't worry, my son. That feeling was simply your eyes adjusting to the illumination of how the galaxy truly works. It passes.
Nivalis looked up from his red hands. Both of his hearts thrummed within his chest. His face felt numb, his lips sliding back from his teeth. He was smiling.
I am this Legion's destiny, its final form, its end state.
So, we will all be like you then, in the end?
Kurz turned slowly, looking upon his son with haunted eyes.
No. Not all. Not you.
The smile died on Nivalis' lips. The Primarch turned back to the void, the spell of his stare broken. Blood dripped from his nose, staining the hololiths in twisting whorls of scarlet.
This crusade is not some grand beginning, Nivalis. This is an end. The end. And it is one that will last an eternity.
Kurz blinked. His eyes seemed to focus again.
Tell me, what is the population of the capital city?
Last census reports it as 8.75 million, my lord.
Kurz looked down upon BNN, drinking in the vista of millions of enemies strangled by a fear he created.
Take the Legion to the surface, Captain. Gather them up. All of them.
Stone and Iron by Robbie McNiven. Performed by Tim Bruce, Cliff Chapman, Steve Conlin, Matthew Hunt, Jonathan Keeble, and Andrew Wincott. The 33rd Grand Battalion of the 4th Legion extended in open order, disdaining the scarce cover afforded by the slope's undergrowth as they attacked uphill. Assault carders pressed towards the skyline beneath the covering fire of iron havocs, even as heavy slug rounds and wickering shrapnel scored and cracked against their silver battle plate.
This is Commander Metellus. Greenskin fire increasing. My vanguard is almost in assault range.
Third Squad Craxus has suffered casualties, but we are about to enter critical range. The orcs will break.
As reports cascaded over the Vox, Perturabo, Primarch of the Iron Warriors, advanced into the maelstrom without pause.
Fear no iron, my son. It is ours to cast and forge and bend. Iron without and iron within.
Hard rounds battered his hulking Logos cataphracti armor, filling the air around him with ricocheting metal. Tech Marine Ferrix, advancing at the giant warrior's side, knew better than to flinch, despite the weight of incoming fire. To be permitted to accompany the Primarch during a storm assault was an honor rarely granted to any outside of the veteran battalions. The voice of Morix, captain of the 103rd Company, crackled over the battalion-wide communications frequency.
We've gained the Eastery down. I am pressing on into their artillery reserves.
You have already suffered excessive casualties thanks to your premature assault. Now you are exceeding your orders with unnecessary aggression. The 103rd will hold its position.
Affirmative, my lord.
Ferrix carried on in Perturabo's shadow, the Primarch's stride unfaltering, even as an orc cannon above discharged directly at him. The detonation, barely a dozen paces ahead of Perturabo, battered the Iron Warriors with a hail of metal and dirt. Ferrix's armor chimed with warnings, and he felt stabs of pain in his thigh and shoulder, his transhuman physiology quickly suppressing the minor wounds. He did not have time to assess the damage. Ahead, his Primarch had broken into a charge. The hammer of Olympia covered the last few yards amidst a storm of shot and shell, mounting the orc's hastily erected redoubt like a rampaging titan. Coming up behind him, Ferrix saw the Primarch silhouetted against the blaze of his gauntlet-mounted combi bolters. Perturabo opened fire into the greenskins, igniting the few orcs not blown to pieces by the point-blank barrage with his specialized plasmic rounds.
They're withdrawing. Focus fire to the left. Enfilade the western bastion.
As Ferrix reached the redoubt beside Perturabo, he saw that Captain Metellus was correct. The greenskins directly ahead had broken before the cold fury of the Iron Warrior's Primarch, fleeing back down the reverse side of the slope. The assault's Iron Havocs were already using the beachhead to bring fire down on the orcs, still entrenched further west, pushing them off the hilltop. Beneath Ferrix, the crude orc artillery lay abandoned, surrounded by the smoldering, bloody remains of those Xenos who had attempted to stand before the Iron Warrior's Primarch.
Sappers to the front! I want ramparts and revetments thrown up along the western slope. Fixed artillery positions to the rear. All company commanders to attend me immediately.
As the Grand Battalion's officers rallied from across the hilltop, Ferrix took the moment's pause to survey the hill surroundings. Behind, to the southeast, the Iron Warrior's drop site was visible, a rocky valley basin now packed with armor and artillery being deposited via heavy landers.
Reserve company deployed, my lord. The heavy armor wave is inbound.
Perturabo had elected to assault the hilltop immediately, rather than stand amidst the orc shelling, waiting for the armored support to drop. The attack had also been part of the test. The 33rd Grand Battalion was unblooded, freshly reconstituted after the slaughter on Perigax. Each of their officers, Ferrix included, was under trial.
The Greenskins are still assaulting the fort to the west.
Ferrix followed his gaze. Below, in a wider, grassier depression, the bulk of the orc horde was continuing its attack on a squat series of rockcrete bulwarks, bastions and ramparts, ringed by a glacis and a razor-wire-filled moat.
The banner on the utmost rampart is that of the 7th Legion.
Imperial fists. What do they know of siegecraft?
Earthshifters and serf laborers were already clambering the slope and setting to work on the west side of the hill, throwing up defensive works with the speed and cold precision only the 4th Legion was capable of. While the work began, the 33rd's captains gathered around their Primarch, the Hammer of Olympia towering over his sons like an ironclad mountain. Morix was among them, but Perturabo did not address him directly.
The Greenskins broke before our iron. I have rarely seen them run so easily. The 103rd Company could have pursued them all the way back to whatever turgid wasteland they crawled from.
Perturabo said nothing, not deigning to look at his captain. As much as he disliked Morix, Ferrix found it difficult not to cringe with discomfort at their father's cold response to his brash words. The post-combat data, scrolling across the visor uplinks of the battalion's officers, showed that Morix's exuberant push on the orcs' eastern defenses had resulted in almost 30% more casualties for the 103rd Company. Perturabo raised one great metal gauntlet and pointed down towards the embattled fortress in the valley below.
Analysis. Tell me what you see.
Craxus, captain of the 105th, was the first to answer.
A dawn-patterned star fortress. Small, estimated company-sized garrison. Ill-sighted. It is overlooked by superior positions to the east and northwest.
Who commands it?
The heraldry belongs to Captain Marcus Vorens of the 7th Legion's 5th Company, 10th Battalion. He is considered one of the Legion's most experienced defensive wall holders.
Now, perhaps he can hold a wall, but he's a fool when it comes to sighting them. As Craxus says, it's overlooked from this hilltop. Had we not stormed it, the Xenos artillery would already have leveled that little outpost.
I doubt the Greenskins were responsible for the rudimentary works here. It appears the Fists were planning on constructing outworks before the attack forced them to abandon the unfinished redoubts. The orcs occupied them, And now we have them.
The answer is not so simple. Wait and watch, and perhaps you will begin to understand. Much can be learned from an enemy, but even more from an ally.
The 7th Legion's 5th Company held the wall. Captain Vorans slapped home a fresh magazine and leaned over the parapet, opening fire on the greenskins clawing up the rockcrete face. He emptied the clip into them, inaccurate return shots cracking from the bastion face and his scarred yellow power armor. In what seemed like just a few double heartbeats, the bolter was clacking empty again. He moved back, the gap on the fire step replaced by Brother Cosberg. The voice of Sergeant Osken clicked in his ear.
Bastion 6 is overrun, Commander. Sergeant Pietist requests permission to engage with the reserve.
Granted, Osken. Bring your own squad and link with me at Bastion 4.
Affirmative, Commander.
Vorans moved back from the bastion towards the central keep, reloading as he went. The situation was desperate. The Greenskins had been throwing themselves at the outpost for almost 8 hours without pause, heedless of the dead they were heaping up all around the jagged angles of the bastions and redoubts. The moat was entirely choked with alien corpses, the razor wire crushed. Had it not been for the 4th Legion storming the hill overlooking the defenses, Vorans knew they would have already been overrun. Yet now it seemed the Iron Warriors were content to simply sit on their hilltop and watch. There was a clatter of battle plate as Osken and the remnants of his assault carder approached from across the fort's parade ground. They'd been counter-attacking orc breakthroughs all day, and their proud yellow battle plate and heavy chainswords were befouled with thick strings of stinking Xenos gore.
Well met, Sergeant Osken. How fares the gatehouse?
We are holding, Commander, but I doubt we can keep them out for long. Sergeant Ganth has sworn to defend the breach to the last bolt round.
Well, that may not be very long, given our current rate of fire. Have you received any word from the Iron Warriors?
Not since their request we abandon the hilltop and provide exact details of our order of battle. Their communication channels remain locked.
Are they really so wedded to defense that they insist on sitting on their hill and fortifying it while we fight and die beneath them?
It appears they have brought up artillery as well.
Vorans looked up at the hilltop overlooking the fort, where the sunlight picked out the silver gleam of the 4th Legion's armor and the long barrels of their heavy guns, freshly entrenched. The Imperial Fist cursed again as the magnitude of the Iron Warrior's inactivity became even more apparent.
Why did they delay? Those guns could break this assault in an instant!
Sergeant Catro claims he has heard the voice of their Primarch across the Voxnet.
If Perturabo himself is up there, what does that mean for the 4th Legion as a whole? There must be reasoning behind their hesitance.
The Greenskins have broken into Bastion 9 again, sir.
I'll bring 2nd Squad up and contain the breach. Return to the gate and support Sergeant Ganth. We have no choice but to try and hold our positions. Keep one ear to the box and hope the Hammer of Olympia shakes off his lethargy. If not, we will all be dead before nightfall.
Perturabo and the 33rd Grand Battalion's officers watched as the orc attacks continued. Schematics of the fort and initial deployments, supplied by the Imperial Fists themselves in a data burst, were overlaying the visor displays of the Iron Warriors as they took in the storm assault's every aspect. Ferrix highlighted part of the fort's display for his brothers with a blink click.
This is their greatest weakness, the Ninth Bastion. Due to the angle of the gatehouse and the main redoubt, it is the first to be hit with overspill from any assault coming down the valley. It was not built expecting such pressure.
You are correct.
Ferrix felt his fellow officers bristle. Every one of them was desperate to earn the Primarch's approval, and the fact that a Tech Marine and not a Bastion commander had won it rankled. For his own part, Perturabo said little or nothing in response to his subordinates' appraisals. The new battalion was being tested, and the results would likely remain private.
According to my estimates, their ammunition will be wholly expended around an hour after sunset.
Not that long. At current rate of expenditure, they have half an hour at most remaining.
Again, Metellus visibly stiffened at his fellow captain's response, but dared say nothing in the presence of the Primarch. If Perturabo was aware of the silent bitterness passing between his officers, he made no indication of it.
If they can disengage from the outer bastions and offer a tighter defense from the central keep, I'd give them a few hours yet.
Lord,
We have been observing this assault for almost 3 hours. In that time, none of you have done anything other than heap scorn and derision on the defensive works below. You disappoint me. Captain Vorons is one of the Imperial Fist's foremost wall holders. From the works you yourselves have raised on this hill and the opinions you have offered, it is clear not one of you would be able to construct the defenses the 7th Legion has here, or hold them against an equivalent Xenos attack for more than 5 hours.
Metellus was the first to find his voice and respond.
But Lord, they're sighting. They abandoned this hilltop without a fight and left themselves utterly exposed. Had we not stormed these positions, they would be already overrun.
They abandoned it because I ordered them to. They abandoned it because I told them I would secure this hill and prevent any Xenos bombardment. You all know not to underestimate an enemy, but neither should you let rivalry cause you to underestimate an ally. They are stone, and we are iron. Both have strengths, both have weaknesses. We are here so that you may learn of both. I see there is still much to teach you, but we are out of time. Artillery Master Lorax, you may open fire!
Aye, my lord. All batteries fire!
The Imperial Fists had to use the last of the Flame of Prometheum to burn the Mountain of Orcs blocking the broken gateway. Once alight, they were able to dozerblade away enough charred corpses to allow access to the fort. Sergeant Oscan approached Vorons over the bodies of friend and foe, his armor bloodied and scarred.
Word from the scouts, Captain. The Orcs are gone. The last stragglers are still withdrawing to the north.
Thank you, Sergeant.
The Iron Warriors' counterattack broke them before we were overrun.
It could have come sooner.
The Imperial Fist tried to master the bitterness in his voice. He stood before the open gateway, while around him his brethren continued to gather their own wounded, stripping precious battleplate from the dead and dumping orc corpses over the walls. The stench of burning Xenos meat was penetrating even the Space Marine's armor seal.
Do we have a final casualty count, Sergeant?
We're still waiting, sir. It's estimated to be over 50%.
Vorons felt numb to it all, his body awash with the aches of post-combat flush, as his systems drained of combat stims and his secondary heart decelerated. Perhaps there would be anger, but it had not come yet. The Iron Warriors were occupying the valley. Beyond the fort's walls, fat-bellied landers were arcing down through the night sky, ferrying super-heavy armor to the planet's surface. An entourage from the strike force that had eventually collapsed the orc's flank was also entering in through the gateway. In the midst of a gaggle of honor guard and officers was their leader, a giant slab of battle-scarred iron that dwarfed those surrounding him. Sergeant Catro had been correct. Perturabo himself was leading his sons. His presence only increased the desolate feeling that had crept over Vorons. The 4th Legion halted before him, and their Primarch raised his fist in salute. Vorons mirrored the motion automatically, though he did not bend the knee.
Captain Vorons of the 7th, my compliments on your defense. It was well made.
My thanks, Lord. It would have been even better made had you struck sooner.
The words elicited aggressive mutterings from the Iron Warriors. But if their Primarch took offense, it didn't show on his firm features or in his cold, slate-gray eyes.
Had we come to your aid immediately, my officers here would have been deprived of the lessons you taught them, Captain. You must forgive the 33rd Grand Battalion. They are newborns. with much still to learn.
My lessons?
The construction of your fortifications and how you carried out their defense. It was imperfect, certainly, but far more adept than anything they could yet muster.
Vorons cast about, struggling to understand, taking in the bodies of his men being removed to the keep, and the orcs still being hauled from the gateway's wrecked remains.
You're saying you delayed your assault so that you could observe how we fought, how my men died?
As I said, it was a commendable defense. Some learned from it, others did not. My own Captain Metellus was certainly among the latter.
The Primarch made a curt gesture, and several of his honor guards snatched one of his officers and hauled him forward. The Iron Warrior began to protest, but one of his brothers struck him a ringing blow around the helmet, silencing him. The Primarch addressed him directly.
You wasted resources during the attack on the hilltop, Metellus, and you disobeyed my instructions for no gain. You are not fit to command in my legion.
Perturabo reached forward and clutched the grim iron skull, the symbol of the Legion, embossed on Metellus' breastplate. With a shriek of rending metal, the Primarch tore the symbol away, ripping power cables and carapace dermal nodes out with it.
You are hereby stripped of your rank, not only before your brothers, but before the 7th Legion as well. You are demoted to the rank of regular in the 5th Company. If you disobey orders again, I will personally see you lobotomized.
The Primarch turned to depart, his warriors with him. Vorons called after him, disbelief still warring with anger, his voice rising above the shriek of more incoming trooplanders.
You're leaving?
Perturabo turned back, a smile as chill as the unyielding metal that encased him, tugged at the corners of his thin lips.
We go in pursuit of the Greenskins. If we had struck sooner, my commanders would have wasted more lives than necessary. And perhaps yours would have been counted among them. The Iron Warriors will complete the purge. Your warriors may rest. You have played your part.
That's it then. You watched my brothers die, and now you leave without another word?
Yes. And herein lies the final lesson. You appear like stone, Imperial Fist. But you merely clad yourself in it. My Legion and I, we are not only sheathed in iron, we are iron. Both without and within.
The 13th Wolf by Gav Thorpe. Performed by Gareth Armstrong, Tim Bentinck, Ian Brooker, Steve Conlin, Jonathan Keeble, and Toby Longworth. Aboard the Stormbird Clawend, the old guard of the 13th Great Company shared a poignant silence. The growl of plasma jets and wind from the thickening atmosphere shook the hull around them. Bullvise stared at each of his veterans in turn, and met their gazes with his own knowing look. They were armored in bulky warplate of storm gray, gilded and silvered, decked with trophies, medallions, and honors. Necklaces of alien fangs and bones hung about their gorgets, and their arms were bound with iron torques. Tatters of parchment, oaths of moment, and honors from the Allfather himself marked them as heroes of 100 wars. Each had been a grown man when the Imperium had rediscovered Fenris. Too old, they said. Too old to benefit from Great Russ's gene seed. Too old for the transformations. Bullvi grinned toothily.
Too tough to die, too stubborn to give up, eh? We proved them wrong.
Halvdan, his single eye shadowed in the light of the troop compartment, asked a question of the old wolf.
Will we offer terms to Magnus?
Bulvi shook his head.
I asked that same question of the Wolf King himself. There is no chance of reconciliation. The sorceries of the Thousand Suns must be extinguished.
Halfdan offered no argument. Ranulf nodded somberly.
We are the Vulka Fenrika brothers, the Space Wolves. They're out. We have come as the Allfather's executioners with a single purpose: to destroy a world, to annihilate its people and render its civilization down to ashes. Prospero, home to the Thousand Suns, Legion of Magnus the Red, the Crimson King. Traitorous lord of a corrupt world, we are righteousness, and that cannot be held at bay.
Jürgen let out a short laugh.
Ha! Yet the power of Magnus protects his capital. Mass drivers and magma bombs have burned all the rest of Prospero, but Tiska still stands.
Yeah! A legion destroying another is a humbling matter. We should take no joy from the destruction of our brothers. Be brutal and efficient, the Wolf King said, but do not glory in the fall of Magnus and his sons. But show no mercy either. The other great companies are already on the ground. We will have some catching up to do.
The hull started to rattle with the detonation of anti-aircraft fire, and the rush of wind grew louder and louder as the gunship descended. With a change of inertia that would have broken the spines of lesser men, the Stormbird fired its landing thrusters, forcing the old guard into their harnesses. Bulvi stroked the sealskin-bound haft of his single-bladed power axe, Eldingafal, the Storm Strike. They landed, the gear hydraulics shrieking below them, and the hull shuddering from the impact. Bulvi stood, hitting the activator for the assault ramp. The brightness and all-consuming roar of battle swept into the gunship. Bulvi lifted Eldingafal, catching the ruddy light on its rune-edged blade, and raised his voice over the din.
Did you not think we would get our hands bloody today?
The fire of countless explosions reflected from the crystal pyramids of the city, the skies lit with pulses of red and blue and orange from incendiary shells, las and plasma. Regiments of scarlet-clad Prosperine Spire Guard flowed down the roads and broad steps towards the Space Wolves. The defenders' tanks and walkers followed, laying down a curtain of fire to meet the grey armored mass of legionaries surging through the capital. Crystal shards and molten metal rained as Bulvi of the 13th led his company through the maze of streets and cloisters. The towering structures of the Syrianus precincts were one of several anchors for the enemy's defense on the inner city, and Russ had tasked Bulvi and his warriors with overpowering the Thousand Suns flank. Now the precincts burned beneath the fury of the rout. Lasfire from the Spire Guard sparked azure beams along colonnaded roads and scoured down from balconies and windows, and a tempest of bolt rounds snarled and cracked in reply. Dreadnoughts covered the advance of the 13th, their autocannons and heavy bolters raking swathes of destruction through the defenders of Tiska. Bolstered by their presence, Bulvi and his warriors pushed further into the city of the Thousand Suns.
Give no thought to retreat. We leave this place with our names recited in the rolls of victory, or in the laments of the lost. The Allfather has called on us, his wolf pack, again. And we will see his enemies torn apart to the last remnant. Give no quarter, for we can expect none in return.
It was not only physical forces and dimensions that broke the landscape. The pyramids and obelisks of Tiska gleamed with another power that distorted the heavens like a coruscating heat haze. Crimson lightning lashed down from the highest summits of glass and white metal, leaving shattered ceramite and fused flesh where they struck. Purple fire rained down from tortured storm clouds that swirled about the pyramids, each burning droplet hissing as it smoldered through armor and seared into flesh. Plasma blasts and cannon fire screeched harmlessly from glimmering shields of unnatural power. Bulvi felt the psychic field prickling his skin, even though clad head to foot in power armor. Its ceramite plates no barrier to the otherworldly energies manipulated by the deviant Thousand Suns. Like a hot wind inside his flesh, he could feel waves of sorcery emanating from the cluster of domes and ziggurats towards which the 13th Company advanced. Another psychic storm swept across Bulvi's warriors, lacerating battleplate with its touch, churning exposed flesh down to the bone. Not one shout of pain or protest rose from the throats of the space wolves as they fell. Instead, they roared their defiance of the Thousand Suns.